Joe Boyd was present for many major moments in music history during the 60s, from the time that Bob Dylan first played electric at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965 to watching Pink Floyd's rise in London as they played in his UFO Club. He's also known for his work with acts like the Incredible String Band, Fairport Convention, and Nick Drake. And now he's written a memoir looking back at his life in the music industry. It's called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s, published by Serpent's Tail. And I'm very pleased it has brought him to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
And that introduction would suggest that it was all rock bands, but you actually worked a lot with blues people. You worked with jazz artists. Do you see them and as all being part of the same sort of thing?
Well, in the 60s, I think it was, in a way. I mean, I write in the book about how we were driven away from pop music in 1956 by Dick Clark and the kind of homogenization of pop music. And it wasn't until people who were very influenced by jazz and blues and folk music retook the commanding heights of popular music that it actually got interesting again.
So is that why the 60s were a particularly fertile time for music?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. I don't know. We could spend an hour on that subject. But I think one of the things that was different about the 60s was everybody was optimistic. And I think when you're really optimistic, you write music differently.
But also the economics of the business, didn't they play a major part?
Well, the economics of the world, the fact that I knew people who lived in Greenwich Village in a great apartment and worked as a waiter three times a week and did occasional gigs, and they could afford it. And so there was a lot of slack, and there was plenty of time for people to just goof off and write songs.
You tell a story about arranging a gig for the blues musician Lonnie Johnson in 1960. Were a lot of young white people listening to black artists at that time? Because in my memory was that if you were seeing blues, you were seeing either an old black musician or a young white musician, not any young black musicians other than perhaps Taj Mahal.
That's certainly true. I don't think, certainly in 1960, very few white people were listening to any kind of blues musician. We brought Lonnie Johnson, my brother, and Jeff Muldaur, and I brought him up to Princeton, and we just told all of our friends, we ordered them, come, pay us a dollar, and sit here and listen. They had no idea who he was.
And you'd found him just living in retirement in Philadelphia?
Well, we can't claim credit for that. We were listening to Chris Albertson on a Philadelphia radio station, and he said, Lonnie Johnson is alive and well and working as a cook in Philadelphia. So we looked him up in the phone book.
Well, he was more than just a blues great. He had a jazz career. He recorded with Louis Armstrong, Eddie Lang, Duke Ellington. I think he took credit, because I remember meeting him, for having the first electric guitar solo on a jazz record.
Absolutely. He was an amazing character. I mean, we used to listen to all those records, you know, the Blind Willie Dunn's Gin Bottle 4 and the Mahogany Hall Stomp and all that, you know. We loved that stuff, and the idea that he was just an hour down the highway was mind-boggling to our young innocent minds.
So is that what got you into the music business?
I think that moment was pretty interesting because you sort of suddenly you had this fantasy about seeing Lonnie Johnson, and then all of a sudden, a week later, there he was in your friend's living room, and he was playing, and you were giving him $100. And that made a connection in the brain somewhere that you could have an idea and then you could manifest it. So that was kind of a good starting point.
Had you been interested in music before? I know your grandmother was a classically trained piano player.
I grew up listening, so I think my grandmother's playing probably helped my ear get formed in a certain way. And then my brother and I discovered jazz records. You know, we just started listening to jazz and blues records, and that was the starting point. And for a long time, you know, we would go and dance at to parties, to rock and roll, and we never made a connection. And it wasn't until I didn't really get the idea of what I could do in the music business until I realized that rock and roll was a continuum, was a continuation of jazz and blues.
And rock started becoming more and more influenced by blues again. White rock became influenced by blues. It had always been a part of the race music rhythm and blues tradition, but now suddenly you had groups like the Rolling Stone doing versions of Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf songs.
Well, in a way, that's what led me to Europe, because it was sort of, it took Europeans, it took English people to resell blues to American white audiences, because Americans didn't really listen to Muddy Waters in the early 60s, but the English people were. And when I took Muddy Waters to England in 1964, it was fantastic, because there was this queue of teenagers, you know, outside the dressing room door wanting Muddy's autograph, and I knew nothing like that would ever happen in America. It was quite an eye-opener.
I once talked to Muddy Waters about playing in a jazz club downtown and at the Apollo uptown. He was doing both in the same week, and he said he had to change his shirt and jacket regularly when he was at the Apollo, but the jazz club was pretty easy. The audiences weren't as demanding.
Yeah.
So you wound up now producing.
Yeah.
Managing.
Of necessity, I never wanted to be a manager, but I kept choosing to produce records by groups that didn't fit into any simple category, and the only way that the records would ever sell was if you came up with some interesting idea about how to get them out there to the public. So I find myself managing people.
And then producing records. We opened with Pink Floyd, Arnold Lane, and that was, wasn't that the first record you ever produced?
No, that was the first record I ever produced. I was very fortunate. I stumbled into a situation where I produced Eric Clapton, Stevie Winwood, and Paul Jones, and Jack Bruce.
That's an all-star band.
Yeah.
What did they call themselves?
Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse. And it was for a compilation called, what ended up with the ridiculous title of What's Shaken, including Paul Butterfield and the Loving Spoonful. But the Floyd, I just did the, this was the height of sort of psychedelic London, 1967. I produced their first single, that record you played.
Mm-hmm. So you almost had some kind of a Zelig experience at times. You seemed to be there when things were happening. For example, Bob Dylan, the first major superstar to emerge from the folk rock scene in America. You've said that his set at the Newport Folk Festival was the birth of rock, and you were doing the sound on that set?
Well, I was the production manager, and I was obsessed with the sound because I'd been to the 1963 festival, and its sound had been awful. And so I lured a wonderful producer named Paul Rothschild up to Newport to do the sound, and he and I worked together, and I was on the stage. He was out on the mixing board, and so he can take credit for the sound mix when Dylan went electric, but I was the one who got grabbed by Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax and threatened unless I could get the sound turned down.
Weren't you the one who actually put the guitar into the amplifier?
That's maybe a bit of a stretch.
Apocryphal.
I put the amps on the stage in the right place and made sure the settings were right and asked the musicians.
But so you were there. Did you know that it was going to outrage so many people?
Oh, yeah. You know, all weekend, the tension was just incredible. It was building up and building up. The old left who had thought all their Christmases had come at once when Dylan arrived singing protest songs were now apoplectic because he was sort of deserting them. And there was huge generational conflicts and tensions that whole weekend.
You say that the 60s peaked on July 1st, 1967. An exact date?
Well, it's a little bit hyperbolic, of course, but there was an evening at the UFO Club in London where I felt the whole spirit of that idealism of the 60s sort of reached its apex. And at the same time, after that moment, you could look back and see how everything started to slide downhill and the drugs got worse and the police started repressing and everything got commercialized and the hippie tourists arrived and the weekend hippies, and the whole thing sort of went off the boil after that.
Well, what was your club like? In England for a long time, if you wanted to see music, you had to join a club. I had to join Ronnie Scott's when I went to school in England. Otherwise, I could not just see jazz as I would in this country.
But that's tied to the consumption of alcohol.
So that wasn't the case with your UFO
We never
club?
Had alcohol at our club. We had we served terrible synthetic orange pop because most people were taking drugs, most of the audience. They didn't want alcohol. They weren't interested. And we rented an old Irish dance hall. And once a week, we just paid the landlord £15, and he let us use it.
And was it unusual for an American to be doing that in London?
I guess. I don't know. I felt so at home when I went there that I kind of settled in, and all my friends were English, and I felt quite part of that whole. There was a guy called John Hopkins who was the sort of Pied Piper of the underground, and he was a good friend of mine, and he was my partner in the club. And it was really the first time that all the freaks from all over London realized there were so many of them. They recognized each other, you know.
Looking at some of the people who performed the list, Pink Floyd, Soft Machine, and Yoko Ono, it kind of surprises me that UFO only lasted 9 months.
Well, it's tied into that business about July 1st, everything went sour. You know, it was great for a while, but then the police pressure got to the landlord. He kicked us out. We had to move to a bigger venue. There was more overheads, and I was foolish, and I tried to compete with commercial promoters, putting on the Pink Floyd and the Soft Machine, because I wanted to hang on to them. I felt it was something we had started and we should hang on to, when I probably should have just let them go to the commercial promoters and start putting on unknown bands and not being so ambitious, but hubris, you know.
Well, everything has changed today. In those days, everybody wanted to record for CBS, Columbia, or for Warner, Electric, Atlantic, or whatever the big labels were at the moment. Today, that all has changed, hasn't it? It's all small labels.
Well, one of the big differences between the 60s and now is that, you know, people write books or articles about the most obscure bands from the middle 60s. I've heard all of them. I know of all those records. There's nothing unfamiliar to me because there were so few records. Now there's an avalanche of records. You can't keep track because the business has become so democratized because it's so much cheaper in a way. The portals are wide open. It was a very narrow portal in those days.
My guest is Joe Boyd. His book, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s, is published by Serpent's Tale, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Richard and Linda Thompson, obviously you worked with them as well, Joe.
I did.
Joe Boyd is here. His book, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s, is published by Serpent's Tale. So when you were part of the London scene, were you pretty much the person who was out there finding people like Fairport Convention and Richard and Linda Thompson and Incredible String Band?
Yeah, that was what I wanted to do, and I was, you know, I was very happy to find myself in London in the mid-60s looking for talent. And Richard was a 17-year-old guitar player with Fairport Convention when I first saw him, playing just so mature. On their first single, he plays a kind of Charlie Christian-style solo on an old Maxine Solomon tune. And I was just amazed that a kid like that, a kid could do things like that. He was extraordinary.
Another artist you discovered, or if you can ever discover an artist, subsequently recorded, was Nick Drake. How would you describe him?
Nick was startlingly original. I mean, he was an upper-middle-class, well-educated kid whose mother wrote songs that were kind of in the Noel Coward, Flanders and Swan sort of vein. And so he learned, he listened to Bob Dylan and Burt Jansch and people like that, and came up with a style on the guitar which was kind of a mixture of the folk style and this very sophisticated cabaret style that he learned from his mother.
Like the Bonzo Dog Band.
Well, no, he's much more sort of...
The Kinks. There's a British tradition, isn't there?
There is, but those are much more working class as a tradition. His was much more elevated and very literate, his lyrics. And his music, people didn't respond to it, I think, in that time because they didn't quite know what to make of it. But somehow, because it didn't become popular in the 60s, I think that allowed young people in the 80s and 90s to kind of take it as their own and make it their own and say, we've discovered this.
But also, isn't there often a desire to almost mythologize people who've had tragic lives? He's said to have committed suicide in 1974. He'd been on antidepressants and was sad about the lack of recognition he was receiving for his work. In a way, it's almost like what we've done to Van Gogh. I'm not saying that they're equivalent, but...
Well, I think
tragic artist, and then later we say, hey, this guy was pretty good. Why didn't we understand it and appreciate it?
Sure, but I think ultimately you stand in a gallery in front of a Van Gogh painting, and, you know, there's no denying, you know, you don't have to know the backstory to look at that painting and say, wow, you know.
But you do for Nick Drake?
I think that it's more to do with what's in the music than what the story was. I think people listened to that sound. He got very popular after his music was used in a very unusual commercial where there was no voices, no voiceovers, no sound, just the sound of Nick's guitar and his voice. And people just went, who is this? This is amazing. And they sought him out, not knowing the story.
Well, you also produced Vashti Bunyan, whose work is now being revisited. So perhaps there were some people just ahead of their times.
Well, it'd be funny to have Vashti described as ahead of her time. Her music is so kind of, rustic and rural and of an older time in a way, which is, I think, again, part of why she's appealing to people. I think there is a certain looking backwards that our culture is indulging in now. Not that she's not worth listening to at all. She's wonderful. But I do think there's a kind of nostalgia for times which were less pessimistic.
Were the drugs of this period the reason that so many of the people in the business were self-destructive? And you worked with a few of them, like Sandy Denny, Syd Barrett, Nick Drake.
I don't think the drugs caused the self-destructiveness. I think
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, I mean, there was. I think the whole mood in the society in that time was much less careful. I mean, when you look at people today, I mean, even young people are thinking about their health insurance and they're thinking about their retirement plans and they're worrying about their career ladder. I mean, people were much more reckless. And I think particularly artists, in order to create things as those people did, they had to be reckless, and they were. And I think that you saw a lot of heedless running toward the edge of experience in the 60s, more so than perhaps you do today.
Well, an awful lot of the musicians of the time, stars Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, they died as a result of their drug use.
Sure, but the possibility that they could use drugs was, I think it wasn't that they were reckless because they used drugs. They used drugs because they were reckless. Just like Clifford, you know, I mean, not that Clifford Brown died of drugs, but I mean the Charlie
Parker. He died in a car crash.
He died in a car crash. But I mean, there you go back into the jazz story and you still have the pattern of reckless behavior. I mean, they're not all well behaved like Wynton Marsalis is, you know.
Joe Boyd's memoir is called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s. It is published by Serpent's Tail and has a lot of great photographs. Where does the title come from?
There was a group that played on that night that you correctly identify as my choice of where the 60s peaked.
July 1st, 1967.
That's right. And there was a group called Tomorrow, and their theme song was a song called My White Bicycle, which was a tribute to the Provos in Amsterdam. And I write in the book that after that night, by the end of 1967, in Amsterdam, all the white bicycles that were given away free so that everybody could ride them, by the end of the year, they'd all been stolen and repainted. So it's a bit of a heavy-handed metaphor for what happened in the 60s.
Well, in New York, people might have said speed killed everything, that there was this period where everybody was loving everybody, and then suddenly along came speed and perhaps too much LSD, and then people were all screaming at each other, and there were groups up against the wall. I can't even say their last name, threatening people's lives. It got rather dangerous
in
the East Village.
It did. The bloom went off the rose, and it happened everywhere. It happened in the West Coast. It happened in Boston.
There was the killing at the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont.
And, you know, and there were a lot of political events. There were killings in politics, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. There was a lot of disillusion set in the late 60s. It was a very bruising time, I think.
You started a record company, Hannibal Records. What led you to do that?
I guess my frustration that trying to pitch other labels in the ideas that I wanted to produce was pretty frustrating at that time. And I was also working, I thought I was a film producer, and I was, I got so tired of waiting these endless years of development deals that I wanted to just do something, go in the studio, and see it out in the marketplace in 4 months.
But the problem in those days, I don't know what it is like today, because I did spend a little time in the record business, was that you had to get distribution. And so you could produce the greatest records in the world, but if you didn't have somebody who was going to get you with the big distributors, you weren't going to be heard.
Well, I'm a great fan of independent distributors. I actually quite enjoyed, you know, I used to sit in London sometimes in an evening, have a dinner party with a nice glass of wine, and then go upstairs to my room and dial Cleveland, Ohio, to talk to Saul, who owed me $5,000, you know, for this shipment of Richard Thompson records, which I'd sent him 3 months ago, and say, negotiating how much of that $5,000 he was going to give me. And then I'd go back downstairs and have my coffee. And I quite enjoyed that world. I like the world of independent distributors. And they did a good job.
You were in a business that was totally different than it is today. We were just hearing about how digital singles are back in the 50s, singles dominated the record business. And then with the music that you're talking about, the album took over and the album concept, and now here we are back with singles.
Yes, although I think that may be a little bit premature to say that's the end of the album, because in Europe, you know, a lot of people selling CDs, you know, ECM Records is having some big anniversary this year. They're putting out a box set and a coffee table book. World Circuit Records is flourishing. They do nothing but albums. I think there's always going to be an audience. Once you pass a certain age, you know, 23 or 25 or 30 or something, you want something a little different.
When you started recording, were you still using analog tape?
I've never used anything but.
You never went digital and did all of the things that have just changed the business totally?
I can't stand Pro Tools. It's natural for an artist to conceive of a song and imagine it being perfect. And Pro Tools sort of allows them to do that, to perfect everything. But I think imperfections are very, very important in a good recording, and I much prefer the old-fashioned ways.
You mentioned an audio engineer, you know, who worked on the Buena Vista Social Club's 1995 album in Cuba, and says that its success is due to that older recording style, the live feel.
I think so. You know, when it first came out, I used to watch people in the bar, you know, who'd never heard the record before. They'd walk into the bar and they'd look around like they'd entered this three-dimensional sonic space, like there might be a group playing in the corner or something. And Norah Jones, I think, the same thing. There was something about the quality of that record that sounded three-dimensional. It sounded warm. And, you know, Arif Mardin did that Norah Jones record in a jazz studio with proper old German microphones and everybody playing together. And, you know, there's life in the old ways yet, whether it's, who knows what the future holds, but I don't think it's necessarily a straight line to everything digital, singles, everything downloaded. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen.
Are you still recording artists?
Trying not to. Trying to write my next book.
Many artists like Devendra Banhart and Joanna Newsom admit to being influenced by some of the musicians that you worked with, like Nick Drake, Robert Wyatt of Soft Machine, and Sandy Denny. Do you think that you can ever return to that special spirit of the 60s and 70s?
I don't think you ever go back to things. Everything changes. Everything evolves. I mean, you know, and I think all art forms or all cultural things have golden ages. You know, they have good times and bad times. I think that was a particular confluence of factors that made for a lot of good records. And when there is another time like that, it won't be for the same reasons. It won't sound like that. It'll be completely different.
Do you enjoy much of the music that's being made today?
Not a huge amount, but I have a huge collection of vinyl that I'm re-listening to and refiling, and that gives me a huge amount of pleasure. And I do slip new things in between every third or fourth LP.
Mm-hmm. Are you willing to share some of those things with us? I know you've been involved with world music. Is that where you found new inspiration?
Yeah, because it's obviously nice to hear things that you're not familiar with and to rediscover something. I went to Ethiopia last year, and Ethiopian music is fantastic. There's that whole series called Ethiopiques. There's about 25 volumes, and
there's even Ethiopian jazz,
which is
American jazz, but not
absolutely
really.
In pentatonic scale with a funny rhythm. We heard Getachew, whatever his name is, the sax player, the Ethiopian leading jazz figure. We heard him in Addis Ababa last year, and it's wonderful. And you know, it's great to explore a new culture, and then you come back and you hear, you know, rock bands pounding out, you know, the offbeat on the snare drum and the kind of thrashing the rhythm guitar, and you think, I've heard a lot of this before.
Well, we had Mulate Astatke on the show, one of the great Ethiopian jazz musicians.
Great.
Is there something that links all the music that you produced over the years? Is there a sensibility that you brought to it all? Or was it just, hey, this sounds interesting, let me try to bring out the best that this person has to offer?
I would like to think it's the latter, you know, that I don't feel I've, you know, I'm not a musician. I've never told anybody to rewrite a song. I don't do, you know, I don't write, I don't play. I'm there to be as invisible as I possibly can, which sometimes is quite a skill, but that's really what I try and do is to push the music to the fore and make it sound a certain way that is clear and warm and makes people feel involved. And my only frustration is that I haven't worked in more different kinds of music. I mean, I've worked in a lot, you know, Latin music and New Orleans music and reggae and, you know, Hungarian and Bulgarian and... But, you know, I've never made a record in China. I've never made a record in...
You're still young.
Yeah, the South Seas. You know, I mean, that's what I'd like to... You know, that's my frustration is that I haven't done enough different things.
Well, in the 60s, we saw a number of rock musicians really interested in those kinds of music, Bulgarian music. We saw Mick Jones of the Rolling Stones go to North Africa to record trance music and that all filtered into the music of the 60s, although I don't think anybody's really done a study as to how much of an influence it's had.
Yeah, I don't know if I think it was a little harder. I mean, I think Brian Jones going to Morocco to record those Jujuka musicians was partly because there was a trail that people followed to those mountains to find where the hashish came from. And, you know,
one thing always led to another.
Yeah. And then Ravi Shankar and George Harrison was another thing. But I think today, you know, with what, Ry Cooder and Peter Gabriel and, Paul Simon have explored in a way more widely than what the musicians did in the 60s.
Will there be another book?
A book on world music.
Really? And that will pick up from where you leave off in the
60s? Not exactly. It's a little different. It's not so much just my experience. I've actually, dare I say it, interviewed people and gone out there and done a bit of research. So it's a little different, although there's a lot of my own experiences in it.
Joe Boyd will be reading from his book and taking questions tonight at Joe's Pub at 7 o'clock. And as an added treat, Jeff Muldaur, Jenny Muldaur, and Robin Hitchcock will be performing along with others. For tickets, call 212-967-7555. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Iranian journalist Camelia Entekabi Fard explains why she was imprisoned for her writings, and then Mike Farrell, best known as B.J. Honeycutt on MASH, talks about his life as an actor and activist. Plus, we learn about the challenges of adapting Sesame Street for other countries, and Ray Suarez looks into the growing entanglement of religion and politics. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephen Phillips Horst and Paula Crossfield. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host, and we'll see you tomorrow.